Hey there, sex fans. Welcome back. Today is Wednesday, March 31st, 2010, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge.
I don't know who you are. I don't know who she is.
See? Well, I'm your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick.
What's up, Doc?
I'm so glad you asked. We're back with more sex wisdom from the photographer, artist, illustrator, art director, and cultural raconteur, Andrew Epstein. And today's music selection, I Go to Rio, is being performed by the brilliant Peter Allen, another of Andrew's loves and photographic subjects. This is part two of what we can safely call Andrew's Dr. Dick Kiss and Tell Tour. This amazing man totally knocks my socks off. He has lived several lifetimes in the span of his 60 years, and we have yet another half hour to come of him regaling us with his wacky exploits. Andrew picks up precisely where he left off last week. It's as if he didn't take a breath in between then and now. And here's news. Part one of my chat with Andrew, which appeared last week at this time, is officially the most popular interview podcast to date.
I think you're making a mistake.
No mistake here. So, yay for that. But wait, did you miss last week's show? Well, not to worry if you did, because you can find it and all of my podcasts in the podcast archive on my site, drdicksexadvice.com. All you gotta do is use the site's search function, type in podcast 195, and voila! Hey, but don't forget to use the pound sign when you do your search. Andrew gifts us with another fabulous slideshow of some of his work featuring his celebrity friends. Look for it on my site. And Andrew also invites you to visit him on his main site, ajepstein.com, or his blog, artdaddy.com. livejournal.com.
We've got to stop meeting like this.
Okay. Today's podcast is brought to you by our friends at adultsextoys.com. Of course, our sponsor carries a hot load of quality name brands like Fleshlight, Lilo, Tantus, and Fun Factory. But here's the amazing thing about adultsextoys.com. They make you a promise. They will not be undersold. That's right, they guarantee the lowest price on the net. And who has money to burn at times like these? Isn't this precisely the kind of competitive edge you are looking for in an online retailer? I know I do. But that's not all. At adultsextoys.com, you don't have to pay sales tax. That's right, sex fans. They paid the freaking sales tax for you. Still not convinced adultsextoys.com is the place to shop? How about if I tell you that they are currently offering free shipping as a promotion? And free gifts just for the asking. I'm telling you people, you can't beat these deals with a stick.
I forgot why I came in here.
Well, all you have to do is look for the handsome adultsextoys.com banner in the sidebar of my site and pay them a visit. You'll soon be convinced, as I am, that they are some kind of wonderful. Okay, on with the show. Welcome back, Andrew, and thank you again for more of your time. It's I'm still reeling from last week's encounter with you. I've had lots of dirty dreams about all the people that you've slept with, and so I'm living vicariously through you, don't you know?
Well, please tell them to me, because I was so drunk I don't remember anything.
So let's pick up where we left off last week.
Okay.
And we were talking about your show, Queer Culture.
Yes.
And you said that these iconic images are the story of many who have contributed aesthetically to our culture, and that you seem to be at the right place at the right time with the right lens. It's got to be more than that, right?
Well, yes. to be honest, yeah. It was funny. One night at a party, at this wild, crazy party at this crazy guy from the UN, And he was giving a party for Tom of Finland.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was, like, doing poppers and, you know, performing for Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just sitting there talking about art. And I said something. I said, it's really interesting. You know, I keep being in places with all these amazing people, and I'm always surprised that I'm drawn to them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been like that my whole life. Mm-hmm. And I said, it can't be coincidence.
Right.
And he laughed and he laughed. And then he finally said, don't you realize, I guess you don't realize it yet. And I said, realize what? And he goes, you are one of those people. You just don't know it yet.
Yeah, how interesting.
And it's like, whoa. I would always meet somebody, you know, out of the blue that it just couldn't have been an accident. You know,
right.
For some reason they were important to me.
Right.
And I'm now at the age where I'm a daddy, you know, and I get all these young queer, angry filmmakers, angry performance artists, mm-hmm. angry artists, you know, and I help them with their art and stuff, and it's nice. But I was telling my friend Harriet, who made me read Bebo Brinker, I was saying, I can't figure it out, you know, mm-hmm. and she said, excuse me, isn't this the same guy that back in his 20s in New York was sleeping with every older writer and artist and, you know, director that you could find? And she says, honey, I think it's called payback.
Ah, there you go.
And so, I actively sought all these people out.
Right.
And learned from them. So that's how I developed.
So you often make reference to the years that you were drunk. You've been sober now how long?
32 or 33 years, I can't remember.
And what precipitated, besides the obvious, the reversal?
Well, I knew I was going to be dead if I didn't stop drinking before 30.
Uh-huh.
And it was funny because when I hung out with people like Mapplethorpe and all that crowd and Lance Loud and used to hang out at the factory a lot,
mm-hmm.
You know, I was such a judgmental drunk. They were all shooting up heroin,
uh-huh.
and I would sit there with a bottle of scotch, you know, wrapped around my arms and mm-hmm. say, oh, they're all drug addicts.
Mm-hmm.
So glad I'm not one of them, mm-hmm. you know. And when you run around with a crowd like that, nobody's going to sit there and say, oh, you're drunk,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then shoot up heroin.
Mm-hmm.
Richard and I were very good friends. Richard Schmeichen, mm-hmm. he was a film editor for the Maisel brothers. I think he even helped edit Grey Gardens.
Really? Interesting.
Pretty sure he did. I'd have to look that up, but I'm pretty sure he was doing that. I must have seen that film a million times mm-hmm. because I was always up at the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And he edited a film for Merchant and Ivory, and he was a great guy, and then he started doing documentary films, and I got involved with them, and we worked on a bunch of stuff for a show called Independent Focus or Independent Lens that was on the public TV station in New York,
mm-hmm.
and we became lovers for a long time, and I would go back and forth between L.A. and New York, and one night I got really angry at my father. And I went on a drunken binge, and then I somehow wound up in New York. And I don't really remember much other than waking up on Richard's couch and him standing there with an orange juice. And I always had said that I would stop drinking if somebody called me an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to be that specific phrase,
uh-huh.
which I was pretty sure nobody in my crowd would do.
That's a good bet.
Yeah. But Richard wasn't part of that crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard was very political and always saw the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
And he just said, Andrew, I think you have a drinking problem. I think you're an alcoholic. Uh-oh. You know, mm-hmm. jig's up. And he said, and there's an AA meeting starting in the village in about an hour, and I think you should go to it.
Hmm.
So he walked me down to Perry Street, which, if you know Perry Street,
uh-huh.
it's like the pit of hell for sobriety. And It was so small, and there was no way to get out that I wound up staying in there for like 2.5 hours because I couldn't get out. Mm-hmm. And when I got out, I was so confused, and I was all over the place. And there was Richard sitting on the stairs across the way, reading the New York Times, waiting for me.
Wow,
nobody ever did that for me. Certainly not my parents, who were both alcoholic, mm-hmm. you know, and none of my friends who were shooting up heroin were about to do that.
Right.
But there was Richard for me, waiting for me.
Got
and
it.
That meant everything.
Okay.
So that's how I got sober.
Well, you know, lots and lots of people from our generation kept running right off the cliff, as it were. So I'm so glad that you survived, because without you, we would not have what we have, and it is brilliant, and it is historical, and it's important, and it's clearly an indication that you love what you did.
Well,
I
think now, looking back at the book and a few other things that have happened to me in the last year, I almost died from a spinal infection, and I lost my job. I was working for this gay entertainment corporation,
yes,
who just screwed me royal, and I had to lay in bed for 17 weeks, unable to move. I couldn't even walk. I got to thinking, and one of the things I got to thinking was that maybe I'm still alive while everybody else is gone. I always felt guilty about that, mm-hmm. you know, that survivor syndrome mm-hmm. thing.
Yes, I do.
But then I realized that I'm alive because I'm supposed to tell their stories.
Right.
And so I'm sort of dedicated to that now. I mean, I have the stories, I have the pictures, and it's my responsibility to educate younger queer guys and women to our history, because right. I don't see it anywhere.
Yes, and you know? Young gay people, lesbian folk, they are unaware of their history for the most
totally.
Part. And it's tragic, it seems
yes.
to me, because it is such a rich and diverse and interesting history. And it also reflects, you know, the culture, the broader culture that we live in. But let's move on to talk about Spaghetti for Brains Press. You mentioned this last week, that your second book is about your involvement with the roller derby. And
yes.
I want you to talk about that, please.
Well, the name of the company is Spaghetti Brains.
Yes. What did I say?
You said something else.
Oh.
you had the words right, but you added something.
Okay, I'll take
Spaghetti
care
Spaghetti for Brains, that
oh.
which sounds good, but Spaghetti Brains is my publishing company I started, because I figured at least I can't get laid off from my own company.
Right, good for you.
And yeah, and the first book was Spaghetti Brains. The second book is going to be called The Blonde Bomber plus The Last Hurrah of Ann Covello and the Resurrection of a Unique American Sporting Event, which back in the 70s, when I was a drunk and thought I'd live forever, I wound up skating in the roller derby.
No kidding.
Yes. And I skated with a camera.
Oh.
And
because you could.
Yeah, because nobody said I couldn't. And well, I sort of skated on the secret. It was weird. I was actually shooting for Playboy.
Wow.
And then it turned into this whole other thing, because they jokingly said, "Well, why don't you try skating?" You know, ha ha ha. And it turned out I was very good, because I played football and hockey,
mm-hmm.
so I knew how to skate and I knew how to block,
mm-hmm.
you know, really well. And so Joan Weston, the Blonde Bomber, the Golden Girl, the Bank Track, the Viking Princess, became my coach.
Wow.
And we became very good friends. And I wanted to shoot from the inside of the track. You know, most of the photographs you see of roller derby are set up, even if they don't look at, they usually are. And they're from the outside of the track. I wanted to shoot as a participant rather than a spectator. And my history with roller derby goes way back because my grandmother, Pearl, used to be in charge of all the concessions for the roller derbies in the 30s and 40s.
No kidding.
So when other kids, other grandmas took them downtown to see Santa, mine would take me to the roller derby.
I love it.
And so I think I met Joni Weston back in the 50s, you know, in the late 50s, because I sort of remember her. And I and my grandmother never took any of the other grandchildren, just me. And I think it was because we were both outsiders in our own family. My mother and her brothers hated her because she was the second wife to my grandfather. And I knew I wasn't even really part of the family because I was adopted. So she and I had a really good bond because we were outsiders.
Cool.
And so she took me to roller derby, and I had always been fascinated by it. And she used to babysit for the Leo Seltzer, who was the owner of roller derby, and then her who she babysat for was Jerry Seltzer, who inherited the game.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one I had to convince to let me go into the infield, and he kept saying no. And then I finally pulled my ace out of the hole, and I said, oh, by the way, my grandmother says hello. I was, who's your grandmother? And I said, Pearl Kahn. And he immediately melted down into a, you know, a young child and said, okay. So I couldn't figure out anything to do with all these photographs because roller derby had died. And,
but there's
and
a resurgence going on, is there not?
A huge resurgence.
Absolutely.
And I spent 10 months on the road with all the new roller derby, shooting them. And then I was friends with Ann Cavello, who was the demon of the derby and the arch villain of the Blonde Bomber. And so, in fact, the next issue of 5-on-5 magazine, which is the official magazine for the Women's Flat Track Roller Derby Association, has got a feature story that I wrote and photographed about Ann Cavello, which...
Holy cow.
I think is great. It's that 5-on-5, they have a website. It's a really great magazine. It mainly goes out to skaters. It's very interesting, very slick magazine. And I finally had an end to the story because Joan and I were going to do a book about her life, except she died.
Mm.
And she died of mad cow's disease.
No kidding.
Yeah, and so that was not a way I wanted to end a book about her.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, I had a new ending, which was the reinvention of the sport.
Hmm.
So that's the second book, and I'm working on that now.
And the third book is also in production, I'm assuming,
yes.
And that's a graphic novel about your adventures with UFOs, right?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
My God, do I dare ask?
I'm the poster boy for outer space.
I mean, not only are you chronicling earthly things, apparently you're chronicling other earthly things.
Yes, well, you know, it's funny because I have a long history with UFOs, and I had something happen to me once outside of Lambertville, New Jersey, where this car was coming right at me. And I'm, like, blinking my lights. This is a country road along the Delaware River, right by where Washington crossed.
Uh-huh.
And I'm blinking my lights. Okay, shut off your high beams. I see you. And he didn't. Mm-hmm. And I was so scared he was going to crash into me that I was in a Bronco. So I was in a big SUV. And,
mm-hmm.
and I pulled it onto a field. You know, it was winter, and so there wasn't anything there. And, you know, I'm going over the ridges where it was plowed and
right,
stuff.
Right, right.
And the whole time, this car stayed in front of me with the headlights. And I thought, this is weird. and I was coming back from an AA meeting 9 years sober, too.
Uh-huh.
So I sort of remember all my blood turning to cherry sugar Kool-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
And I got, all of a sudden, my vision got really weird, and the next thing I knew, I was floating above my Bronco.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, okay, acid flashback from the 60s. You know, I had all this rationalization for what was going on.
Uh-huh.
And I found myself missing about 2.5 hours of time.
Holy
I got God. Back to my house, and I was terrified. And I started reliving something from my childhood, which was similar experiences. And I immediately did the same thing I did as a child, which is I grabbed a giant steak knife. And as a child, I grabbed my baseball bat. This time I grabbed a steel or a copper pipe because they were fixing my bathroom. And went around the house locking all the doors and windows, which was an old, old habit of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I called my sponsor in Philadelphia, Joe, who is this, you know, this gay guy with a big pinky diamond ring that sells cars and gambles in Atlantic City and likes Cher, right? You know, and I'm thinking he's going to think I'm just fucking nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And I start babbling about all this stuff, and he says, and he doesn't laugh at me, and he says, wait, he says, stay there, I'm going to call somebody. And he calls David M. Jacobs, who's a professor at Temple University, and who is one of the leading researchers in UFO abductions,
mm-hmm.
which is very weird that Joe would know somebody like this.
No kidding.
But he had a boyfriend that had an abduction experience, and so he knew David. And David called me and started asking me 20 questions. And after like the 10th question, he said, I want to see you right away. And I went to Philadelphia, and we talked and talked and talked, and he hypnotized me, and I relived a lot of things. And for years, I just didn't believe it, but I thought it was a good story, so I went along with it. And he said he could trace it, UFO abductions in one family, three generations usually.
No kidding.
Yeah, but with me, how could you do it? Because I was adopted, and... Mm-hmm. And if they abducted the whole house, nobody would know it because everybody was drunk, you know. So it's just like, I don't think you're going to, you know, and my parents were dead. So I said, but I'm adopted. And I had just found my birth mother. And I didn't really want to come out with UFOs right away when I met her.
Uh-huh.
But he gave me a scenario to bring up the conversation without saying that. And sure enough, I had a phrase I always used, and I called it the dream. Mm-hmm. I always called it the dream. And the first thing she said, she said, no, I'm an ordinary housewife. And I said, so nothing unusual ever happened. She says, nothing except for the dream.
No kidding.
Yeah, and then she tells me about how these little angels come down and lift her out of the window and fly her up into the night sky. And then she's naked on a medical examining table. And I mean, it was a variation of exactly what I went through. And then I met my first cousin, Tommy, for the first time. And right before I went in, his sister, she said, now listen, I got to tell you, Tommy's a little weird. And she says, you know, he might grab you and pull you aside and start telling you the time he was kidnapped by a UFO. And then she says, but he hasn't been right since Nam.
Oh.
And then I met my other cousin, first cousin, who was the financial accountant for the city of Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice woman in her 60s. And we got home, we had just met, and we got back to my birth father's house, and it was time for X-Files, and I said, would anybody mind if I put on my favorite show? And she says, oh, X-Files? Oh, mine too. So we put it on, and just as it was starting, she says, oh, it's a commercial. I'll tell you about the time that the UFO followed me. So there's three people in my blood-related.
That is
blood
so
related.
Amazing. My good
so goodness. I had the smoking ray gun, you know? So I'm putting it all in a book, but I'm doing it as a graphic novel.
Oh, good for you.
And if you don't want to believe it, fine. Just look at the pictures. You know, I don't care. I mean, for a while, I was like that guy at the end of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the original one, like warning everybody that the pod people
right,
are coming.
Right.
That got nowhere. Nobody cares. Nobody fucking cares. So I just gave up. You know, fine. They're already here anyway, so there's nothing you can do about it.
So in the little time that we have left, I was wondering if you might be able to talk about the Tom of Finland Foundation and Dirk Denner.
Yes.
And the man who established it.
Well, Dirk and I have been friends for 30 years, which is odd. he's kind of crazy, but I like him. I really admire what he did because he took Tom from being an underground fetish artist mm-hmm. who was getting ripped off left and right mm-hmm. and turned him into a world-class artist who now has retrospectives in major museums.
Absolutely.
And Dirk is the guy that did it. You know, I mean, say what you might about Dirk because he's quite a character, but he did it, mm-hmm. you know, and because I was such a good friend of Tom's, I'm involved in the foundation. I do things. He asked me to be on the board. I'm not yet, but mm-hmm. I probably will be. And he was the one, actually, who I started showing some of these photographs that I was finding of Tom and other people. And he was at my house one day during IML when I lived in Chicago. And he said, do you realize what you've got here? So actually, even before Ann Bannon, I think Dirk was the one that sort of planted a seed in my head about all the famous leather people I had photographed. Yes. Not all of that. There's a lot more that I haven't put in the book that I may do a second book. In fact, I'm coming out with a paperback version of my book. Right now, the book is on blurb.com, and it's called Queer Culture. But it's hardcover, and it's a little expensive. I wasn't thinking out of the box when I designed it. I thought it would only be good as long as the show was up. But right. Now the show is traveling, I'm doing a cheaper paperback version of the book.
Oh, good. So, good.
And I'll have information on my website about it. Good. I think Dirk was the one that planted that seed. And Dirk was great because even though he was as fucked up as I was, for some reason he remembers who these people were and the dates and things. And I didn't. I clearly didn't. And I've been digging through my negatives. I just saw an article. Somebody published the book Divine Androgyny online, put the whole book wow. by Pasha. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know that book, but it's an amazing book.
Yes, absolutely, I do. That was another pivotal book that I read like in the early 70s, mid-70s anyhow.
Well, I knew Pasha quite well, and wow. I'm looking desperately for photographs of him, but I know I shot him, but I haven't found any yet. And so there's a lot of people that I just can't find the negatives. I don't know what happened to them. Mm-hmm. When I shared a dark room with Mapplethorpe, he started a fire one night. Having an orgy. He was fisting somebody, and they knocked over poppers and went into the candle. But there wasn't much fire damage, but there was a lot of smoke damage, and the firemen destroyed a lot.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of my negatives got ruined. And I tried to save as much as I could. In fact, the entire roller derby book are photographs that I've fixed in Photoshop. So, but I haven't found the pictures of Pasha and a few other people.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
So there was a connection between Tom of Finland and Mapplethorpe. Yes.
Yes. Yes. That
there's a story.
Yes. Oh God. Yes. And I'm the only one that told it. Apparently, there was a huge. Well, there was the big Stomper show. And it was a three-man show. It was Tom of Finland, Etienne, and then at the last minute, it was me. And Tom didn't want me in the show because he heard I was a young gay artist, and all the young gay artists were just kind of doing strange versions of Tom's
right.
art.
Right.
And Etienne was close, in a way, artistically, mm-hmm. although they were very good friends, and they really aren't alike, but they were alike in some ways. Mm-hmm. And he thought it would be too much to have three people with the same kind of art. But he had never seen my art.
Right.
And I'm a block printer, and I'm not like Tom at all. Mm-hmm. I'm very kind of psychological, and I go on an inward journey rather than, you know, just physically gorgeous guys with giant dicks. That's not what I draw. So Mapplethorpe and the guy that owns Stompers, Louis, set up a meeting between me and Tom at this party, and I brought my portfolio to show him my block prints, and because they thought, you know, at least he should see what he's turning down.
Right.
And that's when Tom and I became friends, because he just loved him. He says, I couldn't do this. I couldn't. I can only draw the surface, what I see. He says, but you draw what's in people's heads, and or your head, and, you know, yes, I want you in the show. But by that time, I had already designed the poster for Stompers, and my name wasn't on it. And then Tom had another show at a gallery called Robert Samuels. And Mapplethorpe was the Robert in the Robert Samuels. He was the silent partner. Right. And it was a very slick show. It was sort of uptown meets downtown. It was in a very professional gallery. Bette Midler was even there. Yeah, I remember seeing her there. anyway, it was a big hit, and a lot of art was sold. But what wasn't sold after the show was put in this truck. And the story was the truck was stolen. They found it in Jersey, you know, in a swamp, and all the art was gone. And Tom never collected on the insurance. I mean, he never got a dime, you know. And Tom was used to that, you know, because that's what his whole art up until recently had been like. He was always getting ripped off. So, you know, it was weird and a strange story. And then Robert used to work for me. I was the first art director ever to give him an assignment. In fact, I bought his portfolio so he could show his photographs. And he was shooting movie stars for me because I was working for Esquire. And I had him shooting Ray Don Chong. And if I always used to get to his loft early because I would have to hide the dildos and the crystal and the poppers and the heroin and, you know, and clean it up so that whoever was coming didn't see all this shit. And I went to the back to kind of look for possible seamless to put behind her because I didn't know how much she was going to wear. And all of a sudden I noticed in the corner this pile of artwork in bubble wrap. And I was just curious. And he did collect Tom. He did buy a lot of Tom's art. But I'm looking at this, and I suddenly realize this is the missing art from the truck from the show. And it was in the back of his loft all this time, and that he had stolen it.
Jeez, that's amazing.
And then when Dirk was at my house during IML, when I was showing him these photographs, and he says, oh, my God, these are all the photographs of the stolen artwork. And I looked at him. I said, you don't know where this was? He goes, no, it was all stolen. You know, I said, it was in the back of Mapplethorpe's loft. He stole it.
Oh, my God.
So Dirk didn't even know for years.
And holy cow.
We figured that it all got sold in Mapplethorpe's estate sale, you know, and we don't know where it went.
Wow.
So,
isn't that
so
amazing?
Mapplethorpe was a very odd guy, and I know it's uncool, but he was definitely not my favorite photographer at all. He was a pain in the ass, and when I got sober, I had, you know, I once tried to get him to go to a meeting. That was a joke. And and I worked with him professionally still, but I couldn't hang out with those kind of people. And in fact, I went about erasing my entire past history with art and Tom and shows. And it wasn't until that meeting with Dirk at my house during IML where he told me I should reestablish myself in history, because there were books coming out like Dirty Pictures, about a wonderful book about Tom of Finland, masculinity and homosexuality, and a wonderful book called Outlaw Representation, Censorship and the Homosexual in the 20th Century American Art, which have pages describing things that I was part of, or I had designed the poster for, or my art was in the show, and my name is gone. And I did that myself.
Yeah.
And Dirk suggested that I reestablish myself and put myself back into the history that I was so important in.
And
so
I am so glad that you did, and I am so glad that you participated here with us, because this is part of, you know, bringing your life and your work to the consciousness of so many people in our audience who heretofore had not known you. But of course our time is up again, and I know.
Did you want to hear about anybody else I slept with?
I do, but We're going to have to do that on another occasion. But before we go, would you give us your website addresses again and walk us around a bit?
My design and the Friends, Lovers, and other assignments and the roller derby sites can all be found on ajepstein.com. And spaghettibrains.com is my artwork and some of my photo essays. Mm-hmm. And artdaddy.com is the original film that led to the book and the show.
Outstanding.
And they may be down for a little bit while I'm transferring hosts, but they will be back.
Outstanding.
So that's about it.
Well, my friend, it's been an honor to spend so much of time with you, and to be in the presence of an icon.
Thank you. I'll glow in that for a while.
Well, you ought to, because it is truly so. And I want to thank the folks who have participated in this series that turned me on to you, like Sean Z and Steve McIsaac, as somebody who absolutely needs to be part of this series. And thank you very much, guys, for that. So we will be seeing you, Andrew, in cyberspace.
Space, even.
And stay away from those UFOs.
I got the implant, you know. I'll let you touch it.
All righty. Be well, my friend. Take care.
Thank you very much.
What a marvelous show. Well, that's it for today, sex fans. And as you probably know, we're all taking a bit of a spring break starting, well, immediately. Tune in a couple of weeks, April 14th to be precise, for more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick.
Was it something I said?
No, not really. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is AdultSexToys.com. Shopping for sex toys is a very personal experience, and not everyone's tastes are the same. That's why AdultSexToys.com carries over 8,000 different adult products, and new items are being added all the time. Not sure what to buy? Check out their best seller page, or their recommendations section, which can be found at the top of many of their sex toy categories. Or simply use their advanced search function to help you find the ideal sex toy for you and your partner.
I beg your pardon.
It's a sex thing. You wouldn't get it. AdultSexToys.com believes that the world of adult products is best explored in a safe, private, and secure setting. Like your own home. What better way to find precisely what you're looking for? And hey, they offer discreet shipping and billing too. Don't miss their hot sale items, where you can score the most popular sex toys for up to half price off. And remember, you never pay sales tax at AdultSexToys.com. Look for their handsome banner in the sidebar of my site and pay them a visit. Tell them Dr. Dick sent you. And look for all of Dr. Dick's podcasts on iTunes. You'll find me in the podcast section, under Health, subcategory Sexuality, or just search for Dr. Dick's Sex Advice. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a comment when you do.
Oh yes, thank you, and goodbye.
Until next time, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Ah, why, that's even better. Over and out.